From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. According to Anna Nardo, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of English at Louisiana State University, the English Renaissance produced an extraordinary variety of self-conscious literary players, among them Shakespeare's Hamlet, with his antic disposition, and John Donne, the 17th century English churchman, in his poses as lover, libertine, and idealist. It follows that a favorite critical term to describe writers and works in English Renaissance literature is playful. But one need not assume that such a description terminates further comment. Here's Professor Anna Nardo.
In fact, if you read the criticism of 17th century literature, mm-hmm. there is no more common word used than play. And these literary critics talk about fanciful, witty, playful poetry.
Do they mean play like, in the same sense that we would use the word?
Well, my contention is that they don't know what play is, which is why I'm going to try to write this book.
Uh-huh.
They use this term constantly, and they have not, for the most part, become experts in the field of play. And many of these critics are often frightened by the social sciences. And the social sciences are the people who study play.
Well, now, there were no social sciences in the 17th century.
But that's the, yeah, of course. And that's the, most literary critics approach it always from a historical perspective. The only way we can read a literary text is from the perspective that the people that wrote the text, the perspective they had on
mm-hmm.
it. Well, I don't believe that. If we pick up a poem and we say, this is playful,
uh-huh.
we pick up a poem by Herbert. You know, you remember the poems by Herbert that are shaped like wings or like an altar. You pick these up and you look at these and you just can't say anything else but this is playful poetry
mm-hmm.
or this man is playing a game. Now, what my question that I'm interested in is, what does that mean?
How would you contrast the meaning of the word play now and then?
Yeah, that's the hardest aspect of this study, is first of all to come up with a really good definition of play. There's a short description of wit by a man named John Harrington, and he talks about what recreation, which was a favorite word in the 17th century, is, and what play is as recreation. And he talks about it in terms of the highest form of recreation being devotion, being prayer. And most of these playful poems, or many of them at least that I'm writing about, are religious poems.
In other words, the reconstituting of the soul.
Aha. Recreation. Yeah. Recreation is a recreation. It is what remakes you.
Mm-hmm.
It is what regenerates you. Now, that is not far removed at all from what 20th century theorists of play understand.
It's been said, Anna, that the cathedral of the 20th century is the pro football stadium, where people go to wash their souls clean, where they recreate themselves.
Yeah, there's a whole literature in the social sciences of really big sport,
mm-hmm.
Large sporting events
mm-hmm.
are seen as by one camp as ritual,
mm-hmm.
as 20th century ritual, and there is a clear structural link between ritual and play, or ritual and game.
Well, can you say that you're tracing an evolution from a religious connotation to one that's almost entirely secular, that is devoid of the religious or the ritual trappings?
Ritual in the 17th century, or maybe even more so in the Middle Ages, and this religious play of poetry that I'm talking about, was play around a center. There is always a center. In the 20th century, what more often occurs is play or ritual around a hollow center
mm-hmm.
or around no center.
Anna, what about some of the connections between what you call the ludic spirit and the literature of the 17th century?
Well, the most ludic or playful aspects of 17th century literature are clearly the metaphysical poets, John Donne, George Herbert, Andrew Marvell, the ones I'm going to talk about primarily, and the Baroque prose stylists,
mm-hmm.
People like Robert Burton, Sir Thomas Browne, Isaac Walton, although his prose is not Baroque, but he did write a fishing manual. So
That very heavy, dense, rhetorical prose, that's what you're talking
and
about.
And very playful prose. The prose of Donne's sermons, the prose of his meditations when he thought he was going to die. I mean, here's a man, you know, on his deathbed, literally playing on the edge. But in each case, what this man is doing is, in each step, playing with allusions, playing with the Bible, playing with the God's book of the creatures, God's book of nature, playing with his disease. He begins each meditation with some part of his body. They bring pigeons to put them at my feet to suck out the humors. And that leads him to a very playful elaboration on the dove as the Holy Spirit. And there's no other way of looking at this but play, a man mm-hmm. playing on his deathbed.
Anna, can you call this stuff cynicism?
No, and that's the real problem that I get into with this definition of play and with the criticism of this literature. Play always creates an in-between world. The reason play does this is that it is a framed behavior. Now, it used to be that people would define play by saying that it is an activity that takes place in a limited time and space by rules generally accepted. Mm-hmm. It fosters freedom and a sense of joy and mirth. Well, all that suggests that anything that you define play, like a football game,
will be hide and go seek.
Hide and go seek will always be play no matter where you do it. That's not true. Mm-hmm. When an NFL lineman breaks from the huddle and comes to the line, he might be deadly serious. I mean, that man's going to get a lot of money for this. There's a sense in which not all NFL football games are play at all. There's nothing playful about them.
Well, from the standpoint of the spectators, maybe, but not from the standpoint of the players.
Not necessarily. I mean, for them, it's a job, yeah. A lot of them. Mm-hmm. So that definition of play is insufficient. A better definition of play would be one that says that it is a defining frame or a context in which what goes on inside the frame transforms itself into something else. Now, the best way I can explain this is to use an example. And the most famous example comes from a man named Gregory Bateson, who went to the zoo and watched otters. He looks at these playful otters running around, chasing each other, biting and nipping and scratching each other. And he says, now wait a minute, something strange is going on here. Otter A nips Otter B. Now, Otter B knows somehow that this Otter A isn't going to kill him. Now, how did he know that? Well, what Bateson discovered was that that playful nip is a very complicated communication that has two levels. It essentially says, this bite does not signify what a bite signifies.
Doesn't mean death or destruction or...
It is
hostility.
But it is a bite, and it might even hurt.
Yeah.
So it is both a bite and a not bite at the same time. All play does that.
Now, you mentioned play as a middle ground between what? Reality on the one hand, just utter, raw, what's out there.
Right.
And
hallucination.
I see.
Or absolute fantasy.
In other words, the purely internal as opposed to the purely external.
Absolutely. And that's why... That's why A, play is so hard to define. That's why B, a lot of people think that John Donne's poetry might be cynical, this man playing on his deathbed. But when one is playing, one both means it and doesn't mean it at the same time.
And therefore he can accommodate
both
topics like death and disease.
Absolutely.
Well, give me some more of these connections between what you call the ludic spirit and the literature of the 17th century. You've referred to John Donne and George Herbert. Where else do you find this ludic spirit?
Well, Andrew Marvel is another example of the playfulness that has often been assumed to be cynicism. People that write about Marvel's most famous poem, To His Coy Mistress, that everybody knows,
sure.
Or The Garden is another poem that everybody's very familiar with. They read these poems, and they're just vastly divergent critical views of them. Some people think Marvel doesn't mean it. He's completely having the reader on. This is just a nothing but an elaborate joke. And then there'll be other very learned critics who will go into elaborate Neoplatonic and Hermetic explications of the depths of the philosophical elaborate realities. And it seems to me that both of those people are right.
Well, Anna, let's talk about the audience for whom this stuff was intended. What kind of an effect did this ludic poetry, this poetry of play, have upon, well, Characterize the audience for me.
Well, the best example of this is John Donne. His poetry circulated very widely and was copied by people in their commonplace books, in their mm-hmm. manuscripts, but it was not published until after his death, largely because he became a churchman and in some ways may have been reticent to publish these very playful and sometimes obscene poems.
Sure, there is this transition between the rakish young man and the Dean
of St. Paul's,
exactly.
Right, absolutely. But now his poetry circulated mostly among men, but not wholly. He had a lot of very learned ladies that he appealed to, patronesses. They were the rising middle class and upper class. They weren't all the nobility. Some of them were courtiers of James' court. Some of them were more like Donne, who were on the fringes. And to give you an idea of how this playful poetry was accepted by his audience, when he died, a fellow poet named Carey wrote an elegy which essentially said that Donne had transformed the age. He'd freed them from the Spenserian kinds of poetry. He'd opened up whole new realms of poetry for the 17th century.
So it had an aesthetic dimension as well as a public one in the sense of poetry circulating.
Oh, absolutely, and it had a whole school of Donne. Well, that's debatable. Some critics think there was a school of Donne that arose. Certainly had many followers, many imitators. And you could ask the question, why? Why did this kind of poetry appeal to the age? What was it about Donne's play that appealed to his century? Well, to answer that, you have to understand a little bit about John Donne. Donne played because play is always in between. John Donne, as a man, desperately needed to be in between. His poetry is filled with a kind of double fear. Fear of separation from the beloved, whether it's a woman or God. You know, all those valedictory poems, the goodbye yep. poems. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, a fear of being engulfed and overwhelmed by the beloved, whether it's a woman or God.
Well, at the risk of overgeneralization, can't you say that's true of just about anybody, this fear of being caught or excluded?
Yes, but not everybody writes as many poems about it as Donne did, and therefore what you can say is this was a key aspect of Donne's psychology. This is something that's present in everyone, but not everyone is utterly obsessed by it, so that it even becomes important in his sermons. Now, if one has this double fear, the best place to be, neither wholly separated nor wholly engulfed or immersed, is right in between.
Is this what's called divine madness?
Oh, I think divine madness is a more romantic term. I think that may fit Wordsworth and Coleridge better.
A way of escape. Or is this escape?
Oh, well, I'd say more defense.
I see.
Because I come at things often from a psychological orientation, seems to me Donne is using play, as Hamlet used play, his antic disposition, as a defense. If I play, then they can never pin me down. Did he mean it? Did he not mean it? I can both approach very closely and at the same time dance away.
Mm-hmm.
And because Donne needed to be in between, he played. Now, why would an age, why would an era, why would readers who didn't necessarily have this particular psychology be interested in this kind of play or gravitate to it or be so interested in it they'd copy it in their commonplace books?
Well, Annie, you're getting at something, obviously, and that implies what? A kind of a transitional device. You're looking sweepingly here in an entire century in mm-hmm. those terms. Is that right?
Absolutely. The 17th century is an age of transition. It's an age in which there are competing worldviews that just come head to head.
And what, just very briefly, what would those worldviews be? How would you characterize them?
Well, the monolithic medieval religious structure was crumbling.
The church.
The church and all of its beliefs were coming head up against a whole new empirical science. Mm. Not just Galileo and the people who were seeing the heavens through telescopes and discovering that the earth wasn't at the center of the universe, but a whole new way of looking at the world. Instead of assuming that there are given truths through which we will interpret physical reality, Bacon wants to then turn around and look at physical reality by itself. Let the eternal truths take care of themselves. if mm-hmm. you're in an age of transition and you've got competing worldviews smacking up against each other constantly, then how do you accommodate that? How do you mediate that disjunction? Play is the perfect way to mediate what's often called a frame disjunction. Now, I have a very mundane example to demonstrate this. Young lady gets on bus. There is young man on bus. She engages in conversation with young man. Lady has this conversation framed in her mind as chit-chat. In the course of the conversation, she discovers clearly that young man has this conversation framed as seduction. Now, here we have a frame disjunction, two worldviews colliding. Now, how are you going to deal with this? She doesn't want to break off the conversation necessarily and get up in a huff. How can she sustain the conversation without being seduced? She can play at being seduced. And in that way, both not be seduced and be seduced at the same time. Play allows her to be in between. It is the perfect mode for mediating a frame disjunction. And in large terms, I think I'm going to try to argue that play was the 17th century's mode for mediating all those colliding worldviews that they were confronted daily.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation with Anna Nardo, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of English at Louisiana State University. At the center, Professor Nardo is writing a book about what she terms the ludic spirit in English Renaissance literature, as manifest in writers like George Herbert, Andrew Marvell, and William Shakespeare.
The more I began to work on these individual figures, the more I began to realize that my argument is much more a psychological argument than it is a historical argument. And I want to try to define something called the ludic self or play self, which is this self that allows you to live in between. I still am interested in history and in a historical argument, but I'm not going to try to argue something so much about the spirit of the whole age as I'm going to argue something about the self created by these representative figures like Donne, like Herbert, like Marvell.
Can you tell me how the ludic spirit or the ludic self manifests itself in subsequent literature?
Well, there is playful literature in every age. That's one of the reasons why I'm shifting to from a spirit of an age to self, because if you think of the 18th century, you've got all that incredibly playful repartee and satire. Although one doesn't usually think of the Victorians as being very playful, you've got Lewis Carroll mm-hmm. writing Alice in Wonderland.
And you have the rise of magazines like Punch, and you have writers like Peacock and Hood. It was a playful spirit. Playful
so
age.
So it would be impossible to pin a ludic spirit down to one age. Mm-hmm. In the 20th century, there is play, and there is a whole literature of play. But it's a much harder kind of play to talk about. My figures, Donne, Herbert, Marvell, those people, knew, even if they were playing in between, they were playing in between two things.
That they knew.
Or I mean, Donne didn't want to be engulfed, or he didn't want to be wholly separated from something. There was a center. Herbert wanted to play his way into God's presence. God was his playmate. He was an inner friend he could play with. The 20th century engages in free play around an absent center.
You mentioned Hamlet a moment ago and the possibility of seeing that great dramatic work in a playful frame of mind. Talk to me about that.
Well, Hamlet himself says he plays. You know, mm-hmm. when he finds out this dreadful event, you know, he finds out that not only has his father been murdered, but he finds out that his mother may have been an adulteress. And he's not even sure whether or not she was party to the murder of his father. He finds out that his uncle is the murderer, and he's up there on the battlements, and it's dark, and he's talking to a ghost, and there's fog.
And he's coping with falling in love
all at the same time, absolutely. Yeah. And as a result of this, when the ghost leaves, he is almost mad. He is literally on the edge. At one point, Horatio calls his speech wild and whirling words. At that moment, he says, I'm going to put on an antic disposition. Now, I think instead of going mad, Hamlet plays mad. And that play, because play is always in between, allows him to both be and not be mad simultaneously. His whole world has placed him in what modern psychologists call a double bind. His mother begins the whole process by saying first, by her behavior, I'm a carnal woman with desires you can't fulfill. Your father's dead. You've got to separate from the family and make your own life because I'm going to lean on this other man, not on my son. And that's what her behavior says on one level. Then verbally, what Gertrude says on another level, which contradicts the first level, is stay here in our court, Hamlet. Love me. Love my husband, whom you have seemed to think is a satyr. Mm-hmm. Clearly, Hamlet's not interested in Claudius even before he discovers the murder. So what Gertrude does is gives him mutually contradictory messages and makes it impossible for him to perceive how contradictory these messages are because of the real, genuine love Hamlet has for his mother.
So a way out of this, or at least a defense, is to adopt this antic spirit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then right after that interview with Gertrude, he goes out on the battlements, and his father places him in another double bind, a more constricting double bind. He gives him four mutually exclusive commands. He says, avenge my murder and your mother's incest. That's two. Don't taint your mind, and don't do anything bad to your mother. It is impossible to do all four of those things. They are mutually exclusive.
Uh-huh.
If he avenges the murder and incest, he will have believed the ghost's blood-curdling tale, you know, pouring poison in people's ears and his skin curling up like bark, you know, this dreadful story. His mind will have to have been tainted. If he does the deed and avenges the murder, he will become tainted because it's against the Christian prohibition, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord.
Yep.
So there is no way he can accommodate both of these commands. He spends half the play trying to do so, and I think he attempts to be in between these two commands by, instead of avenging the murder, playing avenger. He plays avenger by his brutal sarcasm, by his wit, by his wordplay, instead of actually doing the deed. He pours these poisonous, witty words into people's ears the same way that Claudius pours poison into his own father's ears.
Well, Anna, since the play ends the way it does, and since we have called it from time immemorial a tragedy, does this mean that the ludic spirit or the playful spirit fails?
No, that assumes that play is the opposite of tragedy.
Uh-huh.
And the end of Hamlet is a fascinating thing. First of all, it ends with a perfect example of the double bind, because it ends with the sword fight, everybody knows. Hamlet will die by the cup if he wins that Claudius has prepared for him. If he loses the sword match, he dies by the sword. So he's going to lose no matter which way. So it's a kind of emblem of the double binds. Now, everybody's always said that Hamlet is a changed man when he comes back from England at the end. He's transformed. He says, the readiness is all. He says, if my death is going to be now, it'll be now. He comes back with a providential view. God's going to take care of this, and he will decide when the vengeance is to be performed. A wholly different view. Now, I think this has something to do with play. He leaps beyond the double binds in which his mother and Claudius have placed him into realizing that he's playing in somebody else's play. He's playing in God's play. God's the dramatist. God will determine who's going to be the avenger, when the time will be. And it gives Hamlet a whole new level of insight. Another example of this would be what happens when you go to a movie. You go into a movie or a drama into what's clearly a framed experience.
Sure, you
literally
give yourself over to it.
You totally give yourself over to it, and you can cry.
Mm-hmm.
People that could, you know, strong, silent-type men can cry in movies.
Behavior that wouldn't be acceptable necessarily elsewhere.
Right, because within that frame, they're safe.
Yeah.
Movies require you, don't require you to take any action. Or dramas, you're not required to take any action on what's happened in there. It's a set-off, delimited kind of reality so that you can allow undefended emotion to surface. In fact, there's a whole literature of the theology of play. There is one way of looking at the religious man to say that he is the man who lives a narrative life. He lives inside a story. He plays out his life. He doesn't have to assert that he believes, because the person who's always asserting that he believes is the one that needs to make that known. It's almost as if he protests too much. But if one just simply plays out one's faith, then one, in a sense, brings it into being.
The poet Shelley has a wonderful line: "Our sincerest laughter with some pain is fraught. Our sweetest songs are those that tell of saddest thought." Is that the ludic spirit?
Not exactly. That would be the romantic's version of the ludic spirit. But it's close to something that the 17th century had in mind. That play is not mutually exclusive with tragedy, sorrow, suffering, pain. In fact, these people, like Hamlet and Dunn, played best when they played on the edge, on the absolute edge of the abyss. Dunn has that great poem, Hymn to God the Father, in which he says his last fear is that he'll be left on the shore. And he asks God to swear by his son that his light will shine and take him. But that poem is just one series of puns on Dunn's name after another. When thou hast done, thou hast not done.
Play, in other words, at bottom, is very serious.
In fact, one of the theorists of schizophrenia tries to talk about, if I can get a patient to the point where he can play, if he can frame his behavior and have a little piece of him over here looking at what he's doing, and he'll frame the behavior as play, then I can cure him. So I think if you're sane, you can play. And maybe vice versa. Maybe if you play, you are sane.
So Monday Night Football ain't a bad thing, huh?
Well, no, it isn't. There is a problem when you substitute that for genuine play, for what is often called deep play. That's a phrase that was used in the Victorian era. It was a term used to define a kind of play where the risks are so great that it should be banned from society.
The gladiatorial kind of thing.
That's terminal play, absolutely. I mean, that's play on the edge, literally. Or the kind of play that you saw in The Deer Hunter, the Russian roulette kind of play. But there's a way in which you can look at religion as deep play. I mean, remember Pascal's wager.
And the stakes are your soul.
That's right. Absolutely. And Pascal may have been a little cynical when he said, you know, the bet's better. I definitely won't lose if I bet on that there is a God. I might lose if I bet there's not a God. So he may have been a little cynical. But if one plays out one's faith, one is really gambling with a very serious thing. And it seems to me that's much more of a play worth playing than Monday Night Football.
Anna Nardo is a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of English at Louisiana State University. At the center, she's writing a book entitled The Ludic Spirit in 17th Century English Literature. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for Soundings. The English Renaissance produced an extraordinary variety of self-conscious literary players, among them Shakespeare's Hamlet with his antic disposition,
and John Donne, the 17th century English churchman, in his poses as lover, libertine, and idealist. According to Anna Nardo, a scholar at the National Humanities Center, this playful spirit extends into the 20th century, providing an important psychological middle ground for the examination of serious questions about mortality, religion, and behavior. The ludic spirit in literature. Join me this week on Soundings.